Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Welcome to this panel called A Yearning for Learning panel, talking together about the state of education, our concerns, our hopes, our fears for education and ways in which it might change and develop and fulfill more of its purposes, whatever we conceive those to be. So my name is, as you've heard, is Neil. I'm Neil Messer. I'm Professor of Theology at the University of Winchester. So my day job is education. I have an interest in these things. I'm also just finished a spell chairing the Education and Learning Committee of the United Reformed Church, which is the church I belong to and church in which I'm also a minister. So I have that kind of interest in education in that context, as well as in the university where I work. We have a great panel here. Molly Boots, Philip Auger, and Gaminda Bambara. I'm not going to attempt to introduce them. I'm going to ask each of them in turn to introduce themselves. And I'm going to ask each of the panelists in turn to tell you whatever they want to about themselves, their work in education, their experience of it, and their interest in it. And I'm also going to ask them to answer one opening question for me, which is, if there was one thing that you could change about the current practice of education in the UK, what would it be and why? If there's one thing you could change, what would it be and why? So, Molly, over to you first.
Okay, great. So, hi, everyone. I'm Molly. I have just finished my undergraduate degree in theology at Regent's Park College, Oxford, during which I've also been training to be a Baptist minister. And so I've been doing that for 3 years, and now I'm still hooked on education, so I'm about to embark on a medieval church history master's for a year, which is a somewhat unusual thing for a Baptist minister to be doing, but I think that Christian mystics are great. So complete nerd, disclaimer. And my student-y nerdiness is the only thing that qualifies me to be here talking to you about education. But if I could change one thing about the state of education in the UK, it would be remiss of me not to address, especially as an Oxford student, the massive disparities in access to higher education. I only have my own experience to speak from, but I've seen during my time in Oxford that these disparities begin at school. In my college, I was one of only three state school students in my undergraduate year, and I'd been to a super selective grammar school in Kent, so that doesn't really count. Speaking to my tutors, who interview candidates for places at college, the students from private schools do have something that made them stand out. Confidence, or less generously, entitlement. They know when they sit in that interview room that this place and this system was built for and by people like them. And hands up, I have my own fair share of privilege and entitlement. As a white, middle-class, grammar school-educated candidate, I was trained by my school to know the admission system inside out and back to front. And I was told over and over again by my teachers and by my parents that I deserved to go to Oxford. And I'm not saying I'm not grateful for the encouragement and preparation I received, but I meet so many young people, fantastic young people, through my work as a minister in training, talented, intelligent, creative kids who don't have anyone telling them that higher education is for them. Grammar schools and private schools set up such an early disparity in education, which continues to influence the way that people access university and into the workplace. And so I think they need to go.
Thank you, Molly. So, Philip, next.
Good afternoon, everyone. What a pleasure it is to be here and in this spectacular setting on a wonderful day with a really great vibe all around the park. My name is Philip Auger. My main job is to write about banking and finance and business generally. I often write from an ethical angle. I've been critical of banking and finance for the 20-odd years that I've been writing about it. But I also have a sideline, and the sideline is education. In the 2000s, under the Labour government, I worked as a non-executive director at the Department for Education. And more recently, in fact, until just a few weeks ago, I chaired the panel reviewing post-18 education, that's universities and further education and forms of adult education for the previous Prime Minister. And I'm not able to comment on that review. The government is presently considering it when it's not doing other things. But I would like to pick out one particular segment of the population that we looked at in that review. It's not a very fashionable segment at all. And in fact, it is the group I'm particularly interested in, and it's where I would like to make one big change if I could. And that is the bulk of adults in the population who have no educational qualifications. And there are a lot of them. There are 6 million adults in England who do not even have what is called a full level 2-5 basic GCSEs. So 6 million people out there who don't have 5 GCSEs or the equivalent. It's a big number. What is even more startling is that that number is actually rising. In 2011, there were 500,000 adults in Britain who were still continuing with their education when they're out in the workforce. 500,000. So that big rump of 6 million was gradually being addressed in 2011. The number of adults without basic qualifications currently studying has fallen to just 50,000. So from 500,000 to 50,000 in the space of 5 years, it's a shattering fall, and it leaves a vast group marooned without prospects of furtherment. What can explain this fall? Well, the answer, as it so often is money and its funding. Until 2011, if you were an adult who wished to go back into further education, the government would pay your fees. In 2012, that stopped. Now, if you're an adult in employment and you wish to go back into further education, you have to pay half the fees yourself. That is at least £500 a year. So for the people in this group earning probably something close to the minimum national wage, to find £500 after tax is a huge ask. No wonder that the numbers have plummeted. And the single ask that I would have, therefore, is that the government restore a free adult education for all of those over the age of 24. This really matters. It really makes a difference. We have a massive social mobility problem in the UK. It takes, on a present rate of progress, it will take 5 generations for someone from a low-income family even to reach the average. Remarkably, if you were born between 1945 and 1975, I was actually towards the start of that period, you have a better chance of social mobility than someone born today. This simply has to be addressed. The great divide that we had begins to explain the disenfranchised, the dispossessed group that we have in this country who reach for radical populist policies, make surprising decisions at the ballot box. We absolutely have to address this if we are to restore equity, fairness, and social mobility to this country.
Thank you, Philip. And Gurminder.
Hello. So my name's Gurminder Bambra, and I'm Professor of Postcolonial and Decolonial Studies at the University of Sussex. I was centrally involved in setting up the campaign for the public university, which was set up in 2011 to campaign against the introduction of fees that were brought in, or the tripling of fees that occurred at that time. One of the things, and so in that sense, I echo many of the comments that Philip has just made in terms of thinking about the need to bring equality and justice back into our thinking about education more broadly, and I'll just be making a few remarks about higher education. The one thing that I think would be transformational for higher education would be to redirect the university towards global and local sustainability. And that, for me, would require the removal of fees. And let me just give you a couple of reasons for why I think that is. With the introduction of fees into higher education, HE was made an investment in human capital as a private benefit. And it oriented students away from thinking of themselves as learners to thinking of themselves more as consumers who were focused on getting a financial return for the investment that they were making. The introduction of fees also changed universities as institutions, because I think in previously, at least from when the system of public higher education was initiated after the Robbins reports in the 1960s and we had the beginnings of a mass public higher education system, universities were part of the amelioration of social and economic inequality in this country. With the introduction of fees, they've become part of the reproduction of inequality, where economic growth, and in fact they've become engines of that reproduction, where economic growth is no longer inclusive. So a sustainable university, I would suggest, would be one that was not integral to the reproduction of the economic model that's produced the environmental problems that we're seeing around us today. It would rather be one that was practically addressed towards addressing widening inequalities, and it would be focused on facilitating public debate, because I think we need public debate rather than the promotion of what seem to be often private interests of individuals. So I'll just say that where the public university had been central to the processes of deepening democratization in the post-war world by opening up access both to greater numbers of students but also to broader constituencies, because it's only from the 60s onwards that women began going to university in greater numbers, that you had people from lower socioeconomic classes coming into universities in greater numbers, and also BME communities. So we need to return to the public functions of the university and move away from their capture by private interests.
Thank you, Kaminda. So the main point of this session is to give all of you a chance to engage in dialogue with our panel. And we have a couple of roving mics which will be doing the rounds. So if anyone who'd like to ask a question or raise anything that they'd like any of the panel to comment on, please feel free to do that. Please do. Don't be shy in coming forward. Feel free to direct questions to one particular panel member if you like, or just to the panel in general. And all of my colleagues will pitch in as they wish. So yeah, please.
What's the benefit to universities, to the country, to us, of allowing 18-plus education to be so highly selective when most secondary education is comprehensive?
Who'd like to start on that? Kaminda?
Well, sorry, I mean, in the sense that universities require entry grades. I'm not quite sure.
Well, some universities, I mean, Oxford and Cambridge in particular, but the Russell Group are seen as elite universities that lead onto elite jobs for elite people from elite backgrounds. But there's no, as far as I understand it, there's little evidence that that actually leads to better job performance, depending on which university you've been to. So why not make all universities comprehensive and work with people, as long as they can work at that level, take anyone from a local area like schools do?
So I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, I don't think that, at least up until the last set of reforms, which occurred in 2010, 2011, where most universities broadly got a similar amount of government funding, they produced students or they produced degree programs which were broadly comparable, and you wouldn't really have difference in degree outcomes between what are presented as the elite universities and other universities. So I think universities ought to be rooted in their local communities. They ought to serve their local communities, and the shift towards internationalization that a lot of universities are pursuing, they're often pursuing in terms of revenue generation rather than thinking about what their role is within the communities within which they're located. So I would absolutely agree with that.
Can I add to that? Could I just add a little to that? So what I think is happening in universities is that there is a general drift in entry requirements. It's got a long way to go till it gets to the state that you describe, but there is some gentle drift in minimal entry standards. You are seeing a big increase in unconditional offers made to young people. And one consequence of this has been that there is a very welcome increase in the proportion of people from disadvantaged families going to university. Now we have 50% of 18 to 30-year-olds attending a university for the first time. So far, so good. But what happens next? What happens when you're at university? What happens to your post-graduation job prospects, to your earnings prospects, indeed to social mobility? And that seems to me to be where we are rather stuck. It still seems to me that if you are from a disadvantaged background, you need actually more support while you're at university, more help in studying, sometimes more financial support, if you're to take full advantage of that, and if we're to achieve the kind of more egalitarian system that you described. I think that's my personal view of what is happening at the moment. I don't know whether colleagues would like to come in on that.
Yeah, Molly?
I just think that's a really interesting question, because at the moment, in my university experience, the environment that I've been in is a very monochrome environment in terms of the breadth of student backgrounds and experiences. Whereas to have a community that was built up of people who could come from all backgrounds, because I think one of the things that I've seen is that, you know, your intelligence, your educational achievements, you know, obviously people are defined by so much more than that. And if that's the main measure that we're accepting people into university, then you're going to create a particular kind of bubble, which actually possibly diminishes your educational opportunities in a university community, because so much of the learning we do is outside of your formal academic learning in the university context.
Actually, could I just follow this up a little bit more, because it's a really interesting theme. In the course of the post-18 education review in which I was involved, we visited universities, further education colleges, apprenticeship providers up and down the land, and we went to some absolutely amazing universities. Oxford is clearly one. But the ones that stand out in my mind are the universities that are taking a huge proportion of young people from a disadvantaged background. I think of Nottingham Trent University, an absolutely phenomenal place in the Guardian top 20 universities. Incredibly good post-employment prospects, incredibly good results, taking the vast majority of its pupils from low-income segments. Absolutely, they're doing an absolutely incredible job. I went to other universities which have a similar intake, where the results just aren't there, the student support isn't there. You know, there has to be, if you're going to take in a big cohort of disadvantaged people, you absolutely have to work with them to deliver what you promise. So the contrast between the university that you attended and some of the universities out there is stark. Yeah. Some good, some bad.
Thank you. So the question there, and then I think there's next after that will be you at the back.
Thank you. All right, I teach at a 1992 university, and we have a very largely very mixed in every sense intake, but they do 70% of our students live at home. The problem with the thing that you're describing, the kind of complete, I suppose, social equality without looking at putting in work and assessing ability at some point, is that universities like mine are currently assessed on retention, student satisfaction, and whether they're in work after they leave the university. And I will be honest with you, I can do that best by teaching my students very little, telling them what's on the exam, and passing them. And I will get good student satisfaction, and I will get good retention, and because they're able to do a lot of part-time work, they will get a job from the people after that. And that's a serious problem. This summer, my university introduced the idea that students should do 2 resits over the summer. The email that sent me this said, you should write an exam for the summer resit, or you could let them do the same one. And you could let them do the same one on the second resit. And at the bottom of it, it said, you will, of course, have the summer free if all your students pass. Okay, now, yeah.
So, any comments?
Well, one comment in relation to thinking about issues of student feedback and these surveys that students have to do in terms of assessing the quality of the institution on the basis of where students end up getting jobs and so on is deeply problematic, because in a sense what's being evaluated in those surveys is not the quality of the education that students might have, but the possibilities that exist in society from students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, for women, from people from minority backgrounds and so on, being able to access these sorts of jobs. So the very degrees which provide the best education to marginalized groups can't do anything about a labor market that is itself resistant to employing those people in those jobs. So there's been research, if any of you watch the BBC program on the elites, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was, if you come from a middle-class background, having gone to private school, and you graduate with a 2-2, you've got more chance of getting a well-paid job in finance and business than if you come from a lower socioeconomic background and graduate top of your class with a first. So in that sense, that's not the quality of the education that the university is providing that's at issue here. It's about the broader structures within society that need to be addressed. And universities, before they became commercialized in the way that they have and marketized after the reforms of 2010, used to be about leveling the playing field for people, regardless of the background that they came from, providing the possibilities for them to come in, to get a degree, and to go out into the workplace and so on. But the way in which these things have changed and the way in which students have been indebted also makes students much more cautious about seeing university as a place in which they can broaden their horizons and learn what it is to be a democratic citizen for the world. And I think we need to be aware that the changing funding circumstances of universities also changes the students that we end up producing out of those universities. And these two things are not separated. So if we're critical about the consumerist demands either of our students or of our managers, then we also need to look at what the institution is and whether it's being run as a corporation or whether it should go back to being run as a university, which is a community of a particular sort.
Molly, student perspective on the NSS and all that?
Yes, well, we boycott the NSS.
National Student Survey.
National Student Survey.
Anyone who's not familiar with it.
On the basis of it being used by universities to argue for increasing fees. But I think, Gurminder, what you were saying about universities community really resonates, because obviously, as I was saying, the best learning opportunities that you have in that kind of environment are not measurable, and that creates a real dilemma for, I mean, I'm not an educational professional, but I can't imagine the pressure that my tutors are under to jump through hoops, and I see that my mum is a teacher, and it's the same, you know, that starts at school too, this needing to jump through the hoops to get the piece of paper, rather than having a more holistic sense of education. That ingrains in students this sense of being consumers, this sense of this is just something that I need to get my value for money and get out the other end and get those measurable qualifications. That doesn't create well-rounded, fully formed individuals who are independent and creative thinkers. But that's not our fault. It's this need for measurable outcomes in a tangible and statistical sense. And I understand that you can't have that these are useful things, but they're really just tools and markers rather than being an end in and of themselves, I think.
I mean, already in this conversation, we're touching on the multiple demands and expectations that we have on universities. They have to breed good citizenship, develop the country's culture, deliver the students good earnings prospects, produce world-class research. It is actually a really, really big ask. And you use the term the marketization of universities. That's actually what, it's a good term. That's actually what happened. Once the fee cap was trebled from £3,000 to £9,000, university teaching becomes quite an interesting economic proposition if you're a university. Once you then lift the cap on numbers and say to universities, you know, you can expand as much as you like, the more people you bring in, the better. This produces a market of a kind of competitive market in universities, and that's produced some really big benefits. It's produced 50% of 18 to 30 year olds going to university. But what needs to happen now is we need to just pause for breath, start to fine-tune things and say, actually, where, with a laser-like process, can we start to deliver, to help universities deliver this incredibly demanding, stretching set of objectives that we've given them? Once we start to do that, we'll begin to solve the problems, actually, that you, sir, identified in your very first question.
Thank you. So, yeah, next question, please.
I'm a lecturer for the Open University, and actually I take exception to something that was said earlier about adult education being free before the introduction of fees, because it wasn't in the Open University. It was very cheap, though, but it wasn't free. My own first degree is with the Open University, which I did while I was working full-time as a nurse, and I paid for my degree when everybody else was getting it free. We had an issue because when the coalition government came in, we suddenly had to charge the same, well, go for the same product as everybody else, the fees, which we'd never had before. But we could also have student loans, which we'd never had before as well. And we had an unusual situation where we actually lost our middle class students because they were coming to us for second degrees cheaply. However, we retained our working class ones because suddenly they could get student loans when they couldn't before. So I teach health and social care, so I have lots of students who left school at 16 who are working in low-paid care jobs who are now getting a degree. Lovely job. It's wonderful. However, we have a different issue now because the government's goalposts are now saying they want universities to ensure that people complete their degrees. But we've got lots of students who actually just want to come in and do a couple of courses who may never be able to attain a full degree, and we're probably going to get penalised for that. Whereas in the past, they could come in and do one module and do what they could.
Should I just respond to that?
Yeah.
Just for clarity, the free education before 2011 was at level two, so at the GCSE level. But the second point, completely understand your point about the Open University. Okay. And surely the right way to correct the issues that you describe is actually to facilitate funding for modules of degrees. It completely solves the problem and would restore the fortunes of the wonderful institution that is the Open University. It's a terrific place. And modular funding is the key to it.
So anyone else want to come in on that? Yeah. Okay. I'm starting to see lots of hands up, which is great. So I'll ask questioners, please, to keep your questions as brief as you can. Don't feel unduly constrained, but try to try to make questions brief and punchy. And also, I'll ask the same of panelists. Try to keep answers reasonably short and punchy, so that we can enable as many people as possible to join the conversation. So thank you. Yeah,
great. Thank you. Picking up on the points about social mobility and Philip's point at the start about the untrained adults, I'm interested that so far we're talking very much about higher education and not further education. I came through higher education myself, but for the last 3 years I've been working on the technical education reforms, and that's opened my eyes, together with the fact that my mum changed jobs and has been working in a further education college for the last few years as a support worker, to the massive amount of work that needs to happen in the further education landscape. So I'd be very interested, I think, in hearing two things from the panel and indeed from the room, if that's allowed, on what the awareness is of the technical education reforms and the incoming T level from 2020, which could be a real big game changer here. And from the panel, your thoughts on the risks and the potential rewards of T levels.
Well, we can take a straw poll of the tent. Who's aware of this issue that the question has just raised? So a fairly high level of awareness here, which is encouraging. But Philip, do you want to start on that one?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should thank you very much for the further education question. Really, it was very interesting when the panel that I chaired issued its report on post-18 education. More than half of which is on further education. The national press and media, to a woman and man, actually led with universities. So thank you very much for restoring the balance. And the T-level initiative is really important. So in further education, there are a couple of things that trouble us. One is the lack of adults participating, but the other is the swing away from vocational education, and T-levels look to me to be a very important step forward. As an announcement this week, wasn't there, that a grade A in T-level would be the equivalent to 3 grade A's at A-level. That's the kind of very welcome initiative that we want to achieve if we were to close the skills gap in vocational education between this country and our best competitors in the US, in Asia, and indeed in Europe.
Thank you. Gumenda. Yeah.
Just to add a little bit to that, I mean, the FE sector has been one of the ones that's been most extensively privatised, including with the casualisation of labour contracts and so on. And so in order to deliver excellent FE teaching, we're also going to need to address the conditions within which teachers and others work within further education and ensure that there are good jobs for students who go through further education to come into as well.
Thank you. Thank you. So, next question, please.
Yeah, please. Right, I'm going to broaden it a bit, I think. I would be interested to know who you think should make decisions about the structure and progress of our educational system. Educators seem to advise, but members of Parliament make decisions, and a lot of them seem to have no experience in education at all, as far as I can see.
Who'd like to start on that one? Molly.
Goodness. I mean, I think that educators should be far, far more actively involved in being able to make these decisions. Because at the end of the day, so, you know, I'm training to be a Baptist minister. I think that congregational governance is the best way for a church to run. But for people who are actually on the ground with a first-hand experience, because, you know, I'm surrounded by tutors who are constantly frustrated by the constraints that they're under. And I can imagine that must permeate further education in a whole other way, and that it's a so often overlooked sector that people don't understand the value of what further educators are engaging in, and therefore aren't offering them adequate support. So I think it seems clear to me that there should be far, far more engagement with educators in terms of policy making and making decisions about the state of education.
Gumenda?
Well, I mean, the higher education sector in Britain is really a little odd, because not only are we probably one of the most marketized higher education sectors in the world, and we have some of the highest student fees for entry into university education for the system as a whole. So even though there are universities in the US which individually charge higher fees, our entire system is the most expensive university education system in the world. And at the same time, universities are subject to more extensive audit by the government than other institutions. So we're both marketized and utterly bound to government regulations around audit and so on. So I think that does need to be addressed in a clear way. And I think that people who teach in further education and in higher education ought to have more of a role in thinking about the system as a whole. But the thing would be to think about the system as a whole and not just the benefit of their own individual institution, which is partly what's happening with full marketization, is that it's all become about come to my university. My university is the best university. Actually, we had the best university sector. So why don't we go back to promoting the best university sector and then think about these changes in that context?
I think we should ask the chair his comments on that. You are a practicing academic, after all.
I'd agree with what's already been said. I think it's from the point of view of a somebody who works at the coalface of the HE system, it would be nice if you felt that there was more of a real conversation between the people who were driving the policy and the people who are delivering it. I think that's all I'd want to say off the cuff. But yes, yeah, greater involvement and dialogue, I think, seems to me to be really important. And if you're going to have good policy and a healthy sector that where the people who work in it have have a sense that their contribution to the public good is valued and supported by policymakers. So, yeah. Philip, over to you. Back to you.
I mean, I think it's a dialogue, isn't it, between all stakeholders. There needs to be some student input. There needs to be some institutional input from the universities. And the state also has a vote in this. The state is actually providing a lot of the money for post-18 education. Then that they need to be involved too. So getting that balance right is very tricky.
So next question, I think, was there?
Yeah, hi. I'm going to switch it up a little bit and ask specifically about what do you think should be done to increase Gypsy Traveller in specifically educational attainment, because it's shockingly low. I've studied GCSE sociology. I'm only 16. And that showed me how, looking at the statistics of that, over just how low it is. I mean, I think a few years ago, 8% of Gypsy Roma students attained 5 GCSEs, which is shocking. And I think 20 sat A-levels in England last year. It's awfully low, and I think the government has completely failed that marginalised group. And so what do you think should be done to improve their educational attainment?
Who'd like to lead on that one? Guminda?
I mean, I think the results that come out for Gypsy and Roma children and traveller children as well are absolutely shocking, and they are partly also an indictment of the way in which funding has been removed from the education system as a whole. So if we think about the way in which education from schools upwards has been funded, and look at the ways in which schools have had to sell off playing fields, they've had to cut back on extracurricular activities, they've had to cut back on special needs education, on all those other ways in which schools provided support, not just directly in terms of teaching, but also a broader sort of social welfare role that they played. The cuts that have been made to education have stripped that back, so that teachers are so overwhelmed with the basic tasks that they have to do that the other stuff can often get missed out. And despite that, they still do their best to do what it is that it's possible to do in that sort of thing. So I think there needs to be a proper investment, an understanding that the public good requires education to be valued much more than it currently seems to be in terms of the amount of funding that goes into that sector. And then we need to have proper policies in place for reaching out to communities that have traditionally perhaps not been as integrated into those educational models. And we also have to talk to people to see what it is that they want out of education for themselves as well, and how we can include that into whatever it is that we go on to deliver.
Philip?
I mean, it's a really interesting question, and this group forms part of my 6 million, essentially, but there is a clear essential need for a specific targeted policy. And we've done this in other areas. You know, I can recall the London Schools Initiative, I can recall the Black Boys Initiative, which have great results. We could do this if we wanted to. So it's a matter of drawing attention of policymakers to this issue and developing a specific program, and it would work.
I think it is a case of really getting to know a community, especially a community that's so often marginalised and misunderstood and stigmatised. Getting to know what their needs are in terms of what their rhythm of life looks like, and the way that that differs and may not fit within our traditional educational bounds. I think the other thing is creating school environments that are truly inclusive. As I was saying, I think that grammar schools and private schools really do cause harm, not only in creating exclusive bubbles of education in and of themselves, but by then in the counties that have grammar schools, state schools suffer in that their teachers are often farmed off to grammar schools and private schools, and therefore the state comprehensive education is neglected. And I think, I'm from East Sussex, and there are no grammar schools in East Sussex. The state comprehensive schools I've had experience of working with in East Sussex are far better equipped to deal with a breadth of students than the state comprehensive schools in Kent, where students are divided up at 11. So I think it's about creating truly inclusive secondary education would be something that I'm really passionate about.
Thank you. So next question was over here. Yeah.
We've talked a lot about widening access to higher and further education. I'd be really interested, I know Molly talks about it in the first point and just now, about how that really starts in secondary education, and really all the evidence shows it starts when you're age 0 to 3. And one of the biggest impacts to a child is shown through so much education, so much evidence, is that having an excellent teacher makes a substantial difference to progress. And as a head of department of in a secondary school, recruitment is, the situation in recruiting teachers is awful and a real rising sea problem that's quickly catching up with us. And it's partly a higher education issue too. How do you think we can recruit new teachers? We haven't worked it out yet, and I don't know what the government's doing to deal with it. Do you have any suggestions?
Pay them more and better.
Philip?
Pay them more and better, put more resources into school, capital spending, technology, equipment, completely change the status of the profession. It happened about 10 years ago, there was a step up. It needs to happen again now, clearly.
I was going to say putting in place better access to pastoral mental health support for teachers. I can only speak from kind of anecdotal evidence of friends who have recently been through Teach First. And all of them come out of the end of it absolutely exhausted, and several haven't gone into teaching at all, and the others are burnt out and needing to take a break before there's any hope of them going back into it. It's ridiculous the amount of pressure that's put on teachers who are training and the NQTs to take on massive amounts of responsibility with little or no training straight off the bat, with very, very little support, often in struggling schools. So I think putting in place proper structures for access to mental health support for teachers would be something that I would see as being incredibly important, but you'd know more about that than me.
And just to add one other thing with that, because I do think teachers need to be paid more and better, and I also think children ought not to be assessed as much as they are. So I think taking away the sort of... It's that assessment that produces the stress that then leads to the mental health stuff. So whilst I'm not against having mental health initiatives for anybody, let's also look at what causes the increase in mental health cases that have occurred.
Scrap SATs.
Yeah. That gets a round of applause. So next question is over there, I think. Yeah.
I'm also a head of department in a secondary school. I'd agree with everything you said. It's crazy at the moment trying to get good teachers and get good teachers to stay. But what I was going to do is challenge something you said earlier about the unconditional offers and the advantages to disadvantaged students and the increase in numbers at university, because obviously that's a really good outcome. But from our end of things, the unconditional offers may not necessarily be doing the good that you're seeing in the short term, in the long term, because we've got students now, way more unconditional offers coming through than ever before, who are then just giving up on their studies, not bothering to attain what they could attain at A-level, and those grades will still be with them for their lives, going and getting part-time jobs and not coming to school. Now, they can still get onto their course and hopefully will still do well, but that is still something that will be on their record. Plus, for us and the secondary schools, those schools who have more disadvantaged students with more unconditional offers and more students who are doing this, well, I don't need to bother now thing, that affects our results, which then affects our Ofsted ratings, which then affects how we are seen by the community and by the students, and then students see themselves in a different light as a result of that, whether you want it or not. So I would argue that the unconditional offer rise that is your short-term win is actually a long-term fail for our education system. What can you do about it?
So
that's not just giving them unconditional offers, that's my question, sorry.
What do you think about the idea of post-qualification admissions?
That would be lovely.
And the lady in front of you is nodding as well.
And
right.
I think
anything else on
teaching on students to love learning for the sake of learning, not for the sake of standardised testing. You know, I was lucky in the family that I was born into that education was valued. And I was taught to love learning even when I hated school because of bullying. But that's not a given. and a love of learning is not measurable.
Next question was at the front here. Yeah.
So there's some interesting discussion that came from the question around the Open University's focus, if they could, on modularization, and some interesting discussion that came out of the question about T-level qualifications. Is the degree still an appropriate default for an experience of higher education? And that question, particularly in light of the aggregation of degree results towards classification marks, is, could we get rid of the classification while keeping the degree, or is the degree in itself no longer an appropriate default for an experience of higher education?
Kaminda.
I think what we're identifying as problematic are often symptoms of deeper problems. And so I don't think necessarily that it's the degree that's the problem, but the changes that have occurred to the university higher education sector, which are producing outcomes that we deem to be problematic. And I don't think we're going to be able to address the deeper problems by simply focusing on the symptoms. We have to think about the way in which marketization is fundamentally changing the nature of the university, removing it from being an institution oriented to its local community, engaged with its local community, and responding to concerns by people who have a stake in the institution as a community, and then think about these other changes that occur as a consequence to that. I just think that trying to address the symptoms of what has gone wrong isn't going to be the answer.
I think I agree with quite a bit of that. I mean, the issue really that in the UK compared to Germany and the Netherlands is that the degree is the gold standard. There's been a falling away in the status and prestige of vocationally oriented qualifications, HNDs, HNCs. Something needs to be done to restore that balance, to level the scale, really. And that means demonstrating the economic value of other qualifications, demonstrating the cultural value, creating a much broader kind of educational curriculum such as exists in the best of our North European competitors.
Okay, thank you. Next question, I think, was there, is that right?
Lots of universities have programs to try and improve social mobility and reach out to their communities, which is great, but research suggests that rural coastal communities, such as where I come from, are really hard to reach with those programs because there aren't universities nearby. So the nearest one from where I grew up was about 60 miles away. I wondered if the panel had any insights into ways in which rural and coastal communities can be reached so that social mobility of young people in those areas can be improved.
So I'm also from a rural coastal community, and my dad is a community development worker in Jaywick on Sea. And I think his answer would probably be that it starts with getting into schools. That's where you have access to young people who are approaching higher education. And it's about a true engagement, again, with communities that have quite unique markers. You know, rural coastal communities have their own... I mean, Jaywick was rather rudely described as being the UK's only shanty town, but it does have quite a lot of improvised housing. And so it really is, it has unique needs and is on the margins. It's missed off most kind of university level access initiatives. And so I think it is about engaging with teachers and students at a school level through good community outreach. And that's going to take, I don't know what the answer is for what universities can do to implement that, but I think it will take creativity and resources and sacrificing maybe some of their goals and markers for access, but in a way that is more organic and grassroots than just kind of trying to reach their target.
It's a really good question, and you put your finger on a big issue. So on average, 50% of 18-year-olds now go to university. If you look at somewhere like Twickenham, it's about 75%. If you look at some of the poorer regions of, well, I'm thinking of the East Coast regions, it's about 10%. So it's a really big issue that you put your finger on it. So Molly's right, it starts in schools. there also needs to be some evening out of supply of further education. We have 9 further education colleges in Manchester. Vast parts of the country, there are none within easy reach, so that's a big point as well. Universities, it's tricky because the evidence is that students that live at home and go to university, to their local university, tend to come from disadvantaged backgrounds. If you live in the kind of place which sounds as though where you live, there is no local university. So something, I don't have the answer, but you've put your finger on a big issue.
Thank you. Yeah.
I would just want to add to that as well, I mean, particularly this last point about regional access, because one of the things that happened after the 2010 reforms to higher education was that universities were able to compete for students without any cap on numbers of students. So whereas before there used to be a cap on numbers, that meant that students were relatively equally distributed around the country, to universities in more remote areas where there may not be other industry and so on, and the university was the main economic engine of those regional areas. Now that students can go to any university in the country and there's no cap on numbers, that means that if everybody wants to go to London or if everybody wants to go to Manchester or somewhere else and they don't want to go to, somewhere that's more remote or that's not seen to be as buzzing or as lively or student-oriented and so on, then they don't have to go there. And then that means that that university is in real financial trouble, and the trouble that it's in also has consequences within that region, because universities also employ a lot of people from within the local community within them. So I think that issue around that it's not just around aspiration of students, it's also roots into higher education, and having easy access of universities and further education colleges is one aspect. But remember, those same reforms also got rid of the educational maintenance allowance, which was a small amount of money given to 16 to 19-year-olds to enable them to pay for bus fares and train fares to access further higher education. They also got rid of all the other sorts of small-scale infrastructure that supported people in more remote areas to be able to access these institutions. So the landscape we're currently facing is not a natural landscape. It's been produced as a consequence of government reforms over the last 10 years. So the first thing we need to do is get rid of fees. And then remember that there were students who not only didn't pay fees, but they also got grants to go to university. And going to university was an adventure. You didn't want to go to the one closest to home. You wanted to go to one in another part of the country because that was part of what growing up was about. And it was facilitated through public funding for students to be able to do this.
So, thank you. So our next question, I think, is there. We're getting towards the end of our time, so apologies if you've been waiting to get into the discussion and there just isn't time to get to you. I think we can take one or two more questions, certainly, before we ask the panel for any concluding comments. But sincere apologies if you're not one of the ones who managed to get to. But please, yeah.
And to follow on from the lady who's sitting in front of me, do you think education could or should be wrested away from the government of the day? I say this as a long-time teacher, and over all the years, I observe that whenever the government changes, the policy changes, the ton of paperwork that lands in whichever educational system it is goes up. The person who is the education minister can change when there's a reshuffle or an election. I think the top-down power that is part of the system, the way it is organized, is extremely unhelpful to education of anyone, whether you're from zero to adult, because of the waste of money. One of the reasons, the waste of money that goes on because of all the changes. How research is ignored if it's not been commissioned by the government of the day. If the next one changes, I could give you an example of one that happened maybe 10 years ago. An independent research was some independent research was commissioned, which was very sound and worthy, and it was by an independent group. But it was ignored by the next government because they had no input in it. I just think there's so... And also one other thing is the education minister often knows very little about education, and people's perceptions of what education actually means are many and varied, and I think there needs to be a real robust debate on the whole system from the top to the bottom.
100% agree with you, more than 100%. So
how do we do that?
The potential good guys in this are actually probably someone you don't like very much, the Department for Education. The strong permanent civil servants who are there throughout, they actually have to have the moral courage, the mental strength to sort of tell each new minister, look, you know, we can't do that. We have a policy, we're sticking to it. It's my heart bleeds, actually. I shudder to think what it must be like on the front line as these new ministers come in, each with their bright ideas. It's a great point.
Anyone else? No? Some agreement there, I think. So, please. Yeah.
It's sort of a comment about different aspects that have been said. So, if I understand correctly, England has the highest fees on average of any OECD country, and consequently the highest student debt carried for the longest period. It also has, or Britain now this is, among the highest inequality in any OECD country. And we also have failing or falling social mobility. So I'd just like to ask the panel, what is working in education?
Commander.
So one perverse consequence of fees being brought in, and it is a perverse consequence, is that there are now more black and minority ethnic students at Russell Group institutions than there had ever been previously, in part because now universities are more oriented to their fee income than necessarily their demographic characteristics. So that's a bizarre and perverse consequence. And not only BME students, but also more students from lower socioeconomic backgrounds and marginalized communities more generally. There has also been a highlighting now of what's called the BME attainment gap, which is that despite the fact that black and minority ethnic students go into university on the same grades as white students, they often leave with degree results that are up to 50% lower than white students, despite having gone in on the same grades. So the highlighting of those sorts of issues. So to the extent that audit is also a useful tool, can be used usefully, it can be used to highlight the inequalities that exist that we hadn't really taken on board seriously previously and push us to think about how we're going to address those.
So, Molly, what's working for you, one thing? One or two sentences.
I think the fact that liberal arts degrees are becoming more prevalent in the UK is a really good thing, in that students have the option of doing a degree that is more wide-ranging and aren't forced to make decisions about specialising at a very early stage, because I think the UK educational system forces students to specialise quite narrowly, quite quickly. And therefore, I think that liberal arts degrees are a fantastic thing for students that are able to take them up. I do think they should be less elite, though.
Good. Thank you. Philip, any questions? Sitting this one out. So, final very quick question with some very quick answers. Sorry, it's got to be quick, but we're running.
I'm coming from the one body that doesn't seem to be mentioned so far, which is local government, which seems to be the one between the schools and the higher education and things. And the fact that actually government policy a lot of the time seems to actually put us up in almost opposition, particularly the academisation programme, and we still have the duties, but we don't have the powers. Any ideas?
Philip?
Quite interesting to see how a lot of the education budget is being devolved to the mayoral authorities. So that might be a step in the direction that you describe. But I mean, I personally strongly in favour of local connections, local accountability, community institutions, as you describe.
Gaminda, any thoughts? No, Molly. No, any further thoughts on that? Okay, so once again, apologies to those of you who wanted to ask questions and haven't had the opportunity to. But I'd like to close by asking each of our panelists in turn to offer any brief final reflections, 30 seconds each, a few sentences, starting with Molly.
Amy, thank you so much for such a wide-ranging and fertile conversation. I think the main takeaway that I've got from this is the importance of inclusivity and breadth in the way that we approach education, the importance of engaging with multiple voices, especially marginalized voices, in terms of deciding what education should look like and what we should measure as successful education. Our capitalist system tells us that success can only be measured in financial gain, employability, things that can be statistically defined. Whereas what it seems that this room is looking for from education is something that forms well-rounded individuals, but not just individuals, that forms communities at a local level, that mean that that universities, especially, we've talked about with Gaminda, something that is for the local community, that are formed by the local community, that really do feed back into creating a more diverse and thoughtful and progressive society.
Philip?
Great questions on universities, great questions on schools, absolutely nothing on further education or adults. Don't forget the 6 million.
Gaminda?
I think we need a properly funded system of public higher education and a reinvigorated further education system, and these things have to work together, and there needs to be an integrated policy for education as a whole.
Thank you. Thank you all for your engagement with this. It's been a really interesting conversation, set of questions. Thank you for being here, for the contributions you've made. Can I invite you to say a very warm thanks to our three panellists?
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.